A 2010 statistic reports that there are, on average, 29,000 personal bankruptcy filings every week in the U.S., while another statistic from this year reports that, on average, 50,000 pieces of floating plastic per square mile are observed in the Pacific Ocean. How might art be used to convey the magnitude of these statistics? Suppose 29,000 credit cards, images of them, were arranged to compose a larger image of a full moon. Or 50,000 plastic bag images were used as elements to produce an image of a whale. Would you find yourself drawn to the art and then deeper into the story that inspired the art? Our episode today considers how art might be used to convey and engage people to consider human impact on the world or human experience in the world. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Rosemary Pennington, chair of the Department of Media Journalism and Film. Our guest today is Chris Jordan, photographer and artist. His fine art photography series, Running the Numbers, depicts statistics about mass consumption and mass culture. Chris, during a recent trip to the Monterey Aquarium, I saw a piece of your art, Shark Teeth. A nearby poster says that Chris Jordan challenges our use and discard society, at least in this series you did. At the first glance, this was an image of two sharks swimming, but on closer view, the image is constructed from individual images of fossilized shark teeth, 270,000 of them. The question of why 270,000 is that it is estimated that 270,000 sharks of all species are killed globally every day for their fins. How did you first get inspired to create this art that represents mass consumption and mass culture?
I remember so clearly the moment where this project began. And at the time, I had no idea it was going to turn into a multi-year thing. It was just one idea that suddenly hit me in a really strange way. And that was, it was not too long after 9/11. And I read a headline in the New York Times that was, Jeep recalls 800,000 liberties. And it hit me as a really weird pun, because that was right when Homeland Security and like the Bush administration was doing all this militarization and surveillance. And I thought, yeah, I recall having 200,000 liberties too, and they're all being taken away one by one. But then I started reading the article, and Jeep had just recalled 800,000 of its Liberty model cars for a problem with the differential gear. And I'm like, 800,000 of just one model of car? That must go like back to 1963. And then I read in the next paragraph that they had just released the Jeep Model Liberty 4 years previously. And I'm like, 200,000 Jeep Liberties per year? Like, how many is that? And I tried to visualize in my mind, how long of a line of Jeep Liberties would that be? And I realized, I don't know if that's 5 miles or 50 miles or 500 miles. I could not fathom in my mind 200,000 Jeep Liberties per year. So I went to Jeep's website and I took a tiny little JPEG of a Jeep Liberty and I started duplicating it in Photoshop. And I made 200,000 of them. And just by really strange, just pure luck, it came out this long, tall rectangle that looked like one of the Twin Towers. And I was like, whoa, that's weird. I'm going to print it out and see what it looks like in print. And it came out. It was 11 feet long coming out of my printer. And I remember the shock of seeing that number represented visually and realizing I had no comprehension of that number until I saw it represented with my eyes. And that was the first image in this whole series that then led me down a track that lasted like a decade almost.
How did you decide what statistics you were going to focus on in your work?
It was always reading a statistic that just broke my heart. And it wasn't only things about mass consumption. It was like injustices happening, like the number of dogs and cats that are euthanized, the unwanted dogs and cats that are euthanized in the U.S. or the number of women who are getting surgical treatments to their bodies because they don't feel beautiful enough. Like those things are just, it's a tragedy that's happening that's so hard to connect with because the numbers associated with it are so huge that we can't comprehend it.
When I think about these images, they're sort of like what Rosemary asked in that question about the just what statistics sort of engaged you. But then there you had two other decisions that you were making. One are what are the elements that you will use to represent that? And then ultimately, what kind of larger image would you produce? So can you talk a little about those two components?
Yeah, well, this is a process that emerged over quite some time. But one thing that I knew right from the beginning is that I wanted to try to represent the complexity of these issues and to honor it with as many layers of meaning as I could figure out how to build in. And in that way, making these pieces always felt like solving a Rubik's Cube. There's like, what are the small images going to be? What's the big image is going to be? And it could be anything. Each one of them could be anything. And so I would think, like, what is a kind of iconic way to represent whatever this statistic is, but in a way that shows my own complicity and just the emotional or kind of complexity of the issue. And so, like shark's teeth, for example, I read this heartbreaking statistic that is that there are an estimated 100 million sharks killed per year for their fins. And that is taking the shark populations to extinction everywhere in the world. And the biggest tragedy of it is it doesn't need to happen at all because sharks are being killed for their fins because countries in Asia believe that shark fin soup is an aphrodisiac. And what's actually happening is mercury is concentrated in shark fins, stronger than in any other seafood in the world. And it goes to their cartilage, which is their fins. And so people who drink shark fin soup are poisoning themselves with really high levels of mercury. And so I wanted to like build in some of that. And the idea that they're going extinct, that's why I used fossilized shark's teeth. And yin yang, the two sharks in the image are swimming in yin yang relationship to each other, just to kind of remind us of the deep wisdom of that culture that is being forgotten. And then the number is the statistic that takes it down to the number of sharks killed per day. And there's a really cool story about how I got all those shark's teeth. So I thought, okay, I want to use shark's teeth, fossilized shark's teeth. Where can I get a bunch of fossilized shark's teeth? So I went online looking and I found a guy, I think he was in North Carolina, who's a collector of fossilized shark's teeth and he sells them online. And I wrote to him and I said, dude, is there any chance you might be willing to send me your entire collection? It's like tens of thousands of dollars of shark's teeth. Just let me photograph them and then I'll send them right back. And he said, yes.
Oh my
And he
God.
sent, it was only a bag of, I can't remember, it's maybe like 1,000. But it, and what, so what I did is what I did with a lot of the running the numbers pieces, I made like a pancake of them, photographed it, stirred the pancake around, photographed it again. So it looks like 1,000 different shark's teeth. And then I did that for like 2 days until I had lots of different images of the same shark's teeth over and over that I could layer on top of each other. Then I separated out the ones that had more blue color, and so I could make the Chinese characters for mercury, which is what those characters are in the middle. And by really interesting, strange coincidence, the Chinese word for mercury is silver water, which also is like, isn't that what sharks are?
Yeah.
So it all just kind of came together, and there's the to me, that's like the most layers of meaning I could build in there. And so that's the piece, Shark's Teeth.
I'm looking on your website and there are two that are intriguing to me. There's one that seems to reference the birth of Venus with garbage bags. But then there's also, I love Van Gogh. He's one of my favorite artists. And you also have this piece that's referencing the skeleton smoking a cigarette, but they're such different kind of riffs off of those artworks. Can you just sort of talk through your process of how you produced those? And I mean, truly, they are so uniquely different.
Well, first of all, one of the kind of principles that I use in choosing the big image, the experience of the full-size print is exactly the opposite of what happens on when you look at the images on the website. Imagine walking into a museum and you see this huge artwork. You first see it from a distance. And I want to not bring up the viewer's defenses. So it's intentionally not something kind of alarming or dark. It's just, oh, cool, a giant orange rectangle. Or, oh, that famous painting of the Birth of Venus that we all know. And then as you walk up closer, it gets fully in your face as you're brought up. And I optimize the size of the small things so that you have to get almost putting your nose on the print to be able to see what it is. And then there's this little moment of shock of like, oh my God, look, it's all plastic bags. And then there's almost a humor in it. And it's really fun to watch people like, oh, honey, you got to come and see this one. And even kids like love f seeing what the thing is up close. And then you comprehend the number. It's like the quantity is totally in your face. And then only then do you finally read that this represents the number of plastic bags we use in the world every 10 seconds or whatever. So Venus was just made. I went and got, I think I had 70 plastic bags. And I photographed them individually. And I photographed each bag 10 times in different rolled up configurations. And then I really love the Birth of Venus. Not only to me is one of the most beautiful paintings ever made, but there's this profound meaning in that piece is Venus is the goddess of love, but she's not the goddess of sexual or erotic love. That's Aphrodite, who's also in that painting up in the corner, hanging out with her boyfriend Zephyr. Venus is the goddess of earthly love, which is our love for our mother, Mother Earth. And the story of Venus is she was born from the sea as a fully grown woman and floated to shore in a clamshell. And so the mother of Venus, the mother of the goddess of earthly love, is the ocean. And so that was like a perfect piece to kind of illustrate the ridiculousness of our behavior of polluting our oceans with plastic. And the only change I made one small change to the birth to Botticelli's painting, and that is I photographed a plastic bag filled with water and cut it out from its background and pasted it as a tear of sadness in Venus's eye. And that was kind of the process. It's thousands of small individual photographs all joined together or pasted together. And that's one thing I love about this process is even though the prints are super huge, like 8 feet wide, when you walk up close, it's super finely detailed because it's not one giant photograph, it's hundreds of thousands of small photographs that are all very high resolution.
You know that the theme of plastic is, you know, that or the impact of plastics is a pretty common one. And I think, you know, I also love the image of that about the 2.5 million pieces of plastic collected from the Pacific Ocean, that as you sort of step out of it, you all of a sudden see this famous image of the wave. And I thought, what a lovely connection. So did you that, you know, that seemed like a really natural connection. Can you talk about kind of that process and that image?
That's the one I'm most technically proud of. That one took me months to create. And the image file was so huge. I think I remember that it was 130 gigabytes. And that's way bigger than Photoshop was designed to be able to handle. And so it would crash while I was saving it and corrupt the file. And multiple times I had to start completely from scratch after weeks of work. But it finally worked. And that one was built entirely manually, piece by piece in Photoshop. I had no help from any other sort of automation software. And the idea of that one was, first of all, the plastic in the Pacific is the stewards of the Pacific are the West Coast of the US and Asia. So I thought it'd be really interesting to try to build like a cultural bridge across the Pacific and to appropriate a piece of Japanese art to have this conversation about the plastic in our ocean. And Hokusai's piece is, for me personally, it's in the top three most powerful pieces of spiritual art that's ever been made. And the reason it's a very clever yin yang symbol. The wave and the negative space of the wave are a yin yang symbol. And my understanding of that piece is that Hokusai, he was addressing two fundamental yin yang relationships. And one of them is the relationship between stillness and movement, which is the most fundamental relationship in the universe. The stillness of Mount Fuji in the middle and the movement of the wave. And he's showing, and then there are these canoe guys in there that are just about to get crashed by the wave, but they're still held safely. And so it's like the chaotic terror of the human journey at this in the vulnerability to the elements, and at the same time we're held safely by the entire universe. It's this fantastic work of art, all contained in that one image. And so, and then the other yin yang relationship is our tremendous fragility with the wild movement of the elements.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking to Chris Jordan about capturing and conveying statistics about mass consumption and culture with art. We've had episodes on this podcast discussing the problem with plastics. Your work on the Midway Project produced images that translated an abstract discussion of plastic pollution into a dramatic and immediate depiction of impact. Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration for this work?
The inspiration for my Midway project, it came from a desire to face the issue of ocean plastic pollution in a more personal way. Like the work that we were just talking about, my huge photograph of the great wave made out of 2.4 million pieces of plastic, and that entire series that I call Running the Numbers, I always felt a little bit of dissatisfaction around that series, and that is that it was abstract. It's conceptual. It's conceptual art. And up until I started doing that, I never liked conceptual art, and I still don't. It's just too in its own head. And to me, the great power of art is to get us in our body, like to remind us that we feel something. And so, all through the process of studying plastic in the ocean and doing a whole bunch of different running the numbers pieces from different perspectives about ocean plastic, I had this craving, like, how could you face this issue in a more personal way? And I got invited to a meeting held by an amazing activist named Manuel Maqueda. And he, just on his own dime, he brought together a little group of about 10 people in the world who knew anything about ocean plastic at that time. I think it was 2008. And we all met at the Google campus. And one of the people there was a young woman named Anna Cummins, who later has become one of the world's leading scientists on ocean plastic pollution. And we were talking about the Pacific Garbage Patch. And Captain Moore, who is one of the other leading advocates on this subject for all these years, he said, "You can't photograph the Pacific Garbage Patch. It's too spread out. It's like soup. It's millions and millions of tiny pieces that are spread out over hundreds of thousands of square miles of ocean." And I remember in that moment, I slapped my knee in frustration and I said, "Damn, I'm a photographer. I want to take a photograph of the Pacific Garbage Patch." And Anna Cummins, sitting right next to me, I remember this like it was yesterday. She turned to me and she said, "You want to take a photograph of the Pacific Garbage Patch? Go to Midway Island and look inside the stomachs of dead baby albatrosses."
I'm as we're talking, like looking through those photos again, and they are incredibly powerful. And I guess I'm just wondering for you, when you were told that, and then when you go, how do you get yourself sort of in a space where you can take these photos? Because they you have some really lovely photos of young birds, and of, you know, there's a photo of what I'm assuming is a parent and a baby bird, and then in a series you have these images of the corpses of birds filled with plastic. Like, how do you get yourself ready to go take that kind of photograph?
The process that unfolded for me on Midway took years. And it began with a trip to the island that I thought was going to be the whole project. It began that first trip, there were no live albatrosses on the island. It was a time of year when all of the birds are off the island out at sea. It was in September. And so the first experience of Midway for me was like it was like a killing field. It was this empty, silent, horrible smelling place, this small, otherwise magical tropical island. It was covered with the bodies of tens of thousands of dead birds who are filled with plastic. And the experience was devastating for me. And I brought a little team with me. Not to make a film yet, but just to record the process of photographing them and looking at the birds because I knew people would think that I had faked the photographs because there was so much plastic in the birds. And I remember when Anna showed me a photograph that someone else had already taken on the island, my immediate thought was, they put that plastic in there. They had to have. It would be so easy. When no one's looking, you can just add a little extra plastic to make it like to increase your activism. And so I knew going there that there would be this doubt about the credibility of it. And so for just like forensic purposes, I brought a little documentary team with me and we filmed the whole process and we all came back from that trip. I fell into a state of depression. I was devastated by it. And I published that work and it went viral. It was the far more than anything else I had ever done. And that was before social media. It went viral by email. I made a
Oh.
slideshow of the horrible birds filled with plastic and sent it around to my friends by email. And people shared it by email. And tens of thousands of emails started pouring in, not of people who are inspired by the work, but people responding like a trauma response, telling me that they felt panicked and they felt hopeless. And it broke my heart. That's not the effect that I want my work to have on anybody. And I went to my two teachers, my elders, and I asked them, like, can you help me write something or come up with a way that to frame this work of an artist's statement that will make it feel hopeful? And they both said the same thing. They said, no, I can't help you th with that at all. These are the most horrible photos I've ever seen. And they both s said the same thing, which was, you have to go back to that island. It's the only thing I can think of is you've seen a sliver and you need to see more. And I was like, okay, yes, it was incredibly expensive and physically challenging to get out there, but that seems like what I have to do. And when I went back is when I met the live birds. And the other side of the story, the incredible beauty of these beings who have no fear of humans, started to show itself. And we went back again and again when the babies are hatching from the eggs, and you can literally be right in the nest with the camera, and the parents are totally okay with it.
Yeah,
And
the images from
slowly,
there are beautiful.
yeah. So implicit in seeing images like this is a call for change. There's a call for change of behavior, a call for change of action for us. So what are some of the hopes that you have when you produce a collection like this?
Well, I love that question because it really gets to the heart of my intention with all of my work is I don't want to make a call for change. That to me is a fundamentally broken part of the environmental conversation. is everybody telling everybody else how they should change and how they should behave. I trust that if people can reconnect with themselves, if we can remember together that we love our world, I don't have to tell anybody how to behave after that. And it's not my place to tell anybody what they should do once they remember this fundamental thing. It's like maybe one person becomes a passionate musician and just puts love out into the world in that way, in a totally abstract way. Like, I've always thought Stevie Wonder is one of the best environmental activists of all time. Not because he ever said anything about the environment, is because his vibe is just so inspiring in every way. And so I trust that if I can just help people take one step in the direction of remembering love, remembering beauty, then everything else is up to them and they'll do the right thing.
I was going to ask you. I'm looking at some of your work from the Beauty Emerging collection of things, and there's this image from the Strait of Magellan from 2023 that I looks like it must have been a sunrise or a sunset. I don't know. It's beautiful, whatever it is. And I wonder. I know you're sort of moving towards this reflection of beauty. Why are you sort of feeling pushed in that direction?
A thing happened to me during the pandemic that really changed the way I see everything. And really, I guess that this my connection with beauty began earlier than that. It's really like I crossed a midway point on Midway Island making albatross. And that's the arc that I took the viewer on in that journey in my film, is to start with horror and end with beauty and love. And during the pandemic, I finally ran out of excuses not to meditate. And I finally did.
Oh man, do I feel that?
I was completely alone for like a year and a half. And it's like, okay. And I finally did it. And during that process, I had some insights about just on a purely energetic level that I was contributing to the amplification of a darkness in the environmental message. And I just sat for the longest time thinking, like, how do I withdraw the darkness? And at the same time, we have to stay focused on our problems. Like, we can't push the bad news aside and just be all namaste. That's the mistake that the New Age movement makes. And I had this experience of kind of zooming back from the darkness and seeing it as a form in front of me. And we can see that all of the bad news in the world is in one observation we can make about it is that it's finite, and it's also all caused by us. And maybe a ball this small is too small. It has to be huge, but you can zoom even further back, and then it's that big again from a distance. And if one holds all of the bad news in the world, not only environmental bad news, but all of the injustice and all the injustice that's ever been and all the injustice that ever will be, we can contain it in the mind. And if we contain it, then we can stand back at a distance and see that it's contained in a container of beauty that literally goes all the way to the edges of the universe. And I don't want to turn away from the darkness. We have to stay laser focused on it. But how do we focus on it without collapsing into paralysis and depression and overwhelm? And to me, it's to not live inside the darkness like this, but to just zoom a little bit further back and have a perspective, remember the beauty that's all around us in every moment, at every scale. And so that's my new mission, is to amplify beauty, not as a kind of form of denial, but as just a more whole worldview.
Wow, I think that certainly we would join you in wanting to amplify beauty. That is a that's a wonderful sentiment, and it seems like an incredibly appropriate, relevant, and natural arc and continuance of the brilliant work that you've done, Chris. We want to just thank you so much for your time, and well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Always available for more.
Well, Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.